Chapter 5. Kit Palfrey had sent the first few pages of the translation of Naomi's diary to Charlie Gauntlet. They arrived by courier, neatly laser-printed and in an unmarked folder. So Charlie settled down to read the pages on the plane, going from Heathrow to Glasgow. After a long and twisting conversation with Palfrey, Charlie had reluctantly agreed to visit the monks on their stateless island. Because of the beautifully printed, double-spaced manuscript, Charlie found it difficult to take it seriously. He also realized that this had been a problem with the supposed letter from Romilius that he'd read when Kit first appeared, uninvited, at Dolphin Square. Neat little Charlie Gauntlet meditated on the things he'd been told and the words he'd read. If the Centurion's letter was genuine, then whatever the other scrolls contained had to be more than startling. At first reading, Charlie had thought Romilius's words sounded prosaic, commonplace. But thinking about the subject matter, he realized that it was not so much the way in which the Roman soldier had written. The mundane style of the message came not only in the manner in which it had been translated by the monks, but also in the way he had read it. The translators had put it into reasonable English, not the English of the King James Bible, which Gauntlet associated with Holy Writ. Reading law had brought to Charlie a love of language, and his first mentors in what had become his life's work had all been devotees of Shakespeare, so Gauntlet had come to embrace the poet's Elizabethan English. As a child, and particularly in his school days, the rise and swell of the old biblical language had become a great and seductive part of his inner life, as did the elegance of the major poets. Eventually, the books beside his bed would include the writings of Winston Churchill, which added to the luster of his interior life. On the occasions he had been inside a church in recent years, a few weddings, funerals, and two baptisms, Gauntlet had recoiled at the flat, ordinary way in which modern English presented scenes and dialogue from the Bible when clergy had messed about with the Book of Common Prayer. He missed the immediacy of the old translation. Somehow, modern language seemed to demystify the message and made the Bible sound like a novel. It was the same with the Book of Common Prayer. The modern translations subtracted from the Bible and the prayer book, rather than adding comprehension, and Charlie secretly thought the excuses to make the great books more accessible a load of bunkum, for the fire had gone out of both. He still got angry at idiocy, exploding with anger when some schoolmaster declaimed that Shakespeare had lost his relevance to the young people of today. I suppose this parvenu finds it a chore to see the way the bard put up a mirror to life in all times. Charlie fumed. God knows. He appealed to heaven. Charlie was neither theologian nor Christian believer. He found that trying to understand that the Christ story was absolutely true was, for him, like trying to visualize infinity, eternity, space, light years. As he read it, he thought that, in a way, the text of Naomi's diary, as translated by the scholarly monks, came over in the same somewhat flat and impersonal style that had impregnated the letter from Romilius. Charlie had to constantly remind himself that this wasn't necessarily a fiction, but possibly a revelatory find that would explode, giving hope and certainty to all humankind. This was not easy, but seated in the comfortable club-class seat, Charlie began to read, aware that the words could well be part of a giant tapestry, reaching back from the past to be active now in the present. Naomi had dictated, "My friend, customer and teacher, the centurion Titus Romilius, has sent Petros to me. He has explained what must be done, and young Petros seems to be the kind of man who cannot be made to blush. It is hard to tell because the boy is dumb, and only communicates through signs with his hands and expressions on his face. He's lively, though, always smiling, and makes laughing noises whenever there is mention of physical gratification, by which I mean sex. Romilius was there when he arrived, and Petros signaled that he thought I was pretty. This is good, for he has to work close to me, but he will only give love to the men who want a boy. Romilius has explained all this to me. Petros was brought from an island somewhere off the coast of Greece. A brother centurion saved the boy from death and found that he's very intelligent, in spite of not being able to speak. He has studied hard, and now he can understand the Roman and Greek tongues, as well as my language and that of the Egyptians. Romilius has suggested that I should first say something about myself. This is difficult for me, being a woman, and therefore in subjugation to my betters. Indeed, I am a simple person who likes easy things, such as watching the sun rise and set, marveling at the beauty of flowers and plants, or my husband's smile and the look in his eyes. I used to adore just sitting in the high ground above what was once my home and looking out over the city of Ascalon and seeing the sea sparkle in the distance. Tomorrow we leave Hebron and go to Jerusalem. I've never been there and am very excited, as Romilius says there's already a house waiting for us, and we will be safe, for we shall be under his protection. Perhaps this is the true turning point in my life that has known so much sorrow in the past 3 years. A Nubian girl called Azeb is already at the Jerusalem house. She is young and will clean, cook, and is old enough to have men should they desire her. Romilius says that I must tell Petros of the bad times when my husband died, so I shall do that now. My husband James had offended his family by marrying me, for they had wanted him to marry a girl called Sarah, the daughter of an old family friend called Isaac ben Ehud. This would have meant a great increase in sheep, goats, and land, because Sarah's father owned a larger herd than my husband, together with 2 fields of corn, against James's 1 small field. In the end, James refused to be betrothed to Sarah, for he loved me, and I him, with a deep and strong bond. We entered into the marriage with gravity and honour. James and his family were quite ignorant people, though James did not realize how ignorant he was. How could he be otherwise? He never spoke with learned men, so he knew no difference. Looking after herds of sheep and goats all day and night does not exercise the mind. At least my father was a scholarly man, and while he did not think women needed education so that they might read or write, he saw that I grew up in the shadow of good talk and knowledge of the things that mattered in our faith. Even though James was an unlettered man, I loved him. He could make me laugh and give me happiness with a simple thing like a smile. He also satisfied me in physical lovemaking. I did not need much to keep me happy, and James managed to do that most of the time, even though he was a lot older than I. God grant us all that ability, Gauntlet thought as he turned the page. Alas, it was to be a happy but short-lived marriage. I did not become pregnant as we'd hoped and prayed, and this was not for want of trying. I was a dutiful and loving wife to James, and we were vigorous and happy when we lay down together, something I enjoyed as much as he did. Some of the older women I spoke with in Ascalon were critical of me. They would gossip and say it was not natural for a woman to enjoy the loving as much as I, though many of the younger women agreed with my views, and they looked forward to the evenings and night time when they could satisfy their husbands with as much ardour as I showed. Many times I heard people say that only harlots enjoy physical love. What nonsense! Now I know that the harlot seldom likes the coupling she is forced into for money, or lack of it. One of the women, Anna, a beautiful girl, became a close friend. She was taller than I, a well-formed girl with dark eyes and long black hair that came down below her waist. 6 months or so after my marriage, I spent one afternoon with her. We kissed and fondled each other on the mattress where I slept with James. Anna took the man's part first, then we changed over. It was pleasant, and neither of us felt in any way awkward. It was a nice game, and there was no need to feel guilty afterward. Anna told me frankly some of the things she did with her husband, and I repeated her all manner of acts I did with James. I think she was shocked at first when I told her what I did with my lips and mouth. I have never thought of that as sinful. Anyway, she said she would try it with her David, and much fortune to her. It made James like a wild thing, though the first time I did it he seemed angry and beat me, which was oddly pleasant, as he was very masterful. Finally, I was blamed for James's death because of my enthusiasm for making love with him. I had ground corn and made bread one morning in the spring, toward the end of our first year of marriage. I let the unleavened bread cool, and then took it out into the fields to James, together with a jug of wine and some chicken that I'd cooked with herbs and spices. I always kept strictly to the laws of food in which my mother, who was a devout person, had long instructed me.